Welcome to Machiavelli in the Ivory Tower, a videocast series on arms control, non-proliferation, and related international security issues. I'm Sarah Bidgood, director of the Eurasia Non-Proliferation Program at the James Martin Center for Non-Proliferation Studies in Monterey, California.
And I'm Hannah Notte, senior research associate at the Vienna Center for Disarmament and Non-Proliferation.
Join us as we discuss cutting-edge research and what it means for real-world decision-makers. Whether it's nuclear doctrine, deterrence dynamics, regional challenges, or the state of international regimes, there's just so much to talk about.
And with our guests, we'll break down how their analysis can help us make sense of a complex security landscape.
In each episode, we'll bring Machiavelli into the Ivory Tower.
Thanks for watching. We're glad you're along for the ride.
Welcome to Machiavelli in the Ivory Tower. Our guest today is Dr. Kristin Van Brusgaard, who is a postdoctoral fellow and an assistant professor of political science at the University of Oslo, where she's also part of the Oslo Nuclear Project. Kristin, welcome. It's so great to see you, and thank you for making the time to speak with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a great pleasure to be here.
So Kristin, you had a great piece come out last year in the Journal of Strategic Studies, where you looked at Russian nuclear strategy and conventional inferiority. So I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about how Russia's conventional forces has evolved over the course of the last decade, and what some of the implications of that evolution might be for the ongoing war in Ukraine.
So my article in the Journal of Strategic Studies is basically about the interrelationship between conventional forces and the conventional correlation of forces and nuclear strategy outcomes. And it explains how Russian nuclear strategy has evolved or changed in the post-Cold War era as a result of changes in the Russian perception of the conventional correlation of forces and how Russian conventional forces compared to Western conventional forces and NATO conventional forces or US conventional forces. One of the key points of the article is that it challenges this notion that the Russian threshold for nuclear weapons use is now very low and that it's lower now than ever before. As it demonstrates that the Russian nuclear threshold was much lower earlier in the post-Cold War period, but that this threshold has likely changed and shifted upwards as a result of a conventional force modernization that has taken place in Russia in the past 15 years. So I make this argument about how the conventional balance of forces influences nuclear strategy choices and makes a state like Russia more or less dependent on its nuclear forces, and that Russia, after 2010, essentially, has become less reliant on its nuclear forces as a result of this modernization of its conventional force and this declared, basically improved conventional capability of the Russian military. And one of the things that I talk about at length in this article is how Russian military strategists and planners have for a pretty long time advocated the need for better conventional force options in order to deal with a range of different contingencies and different types of conflicts. And that includes this conflict type that Russian planners and strategists would call a local war, that is a limited war between a limited number of powers, which is essentially the type of war that we are now seeing in Ukraine. I demonstrate how Russian strategists, Russian planners, Russian doctrine, and Russian forces have evolved to become better able, or at least to try to become better able to deal with such wars with conventional forces only, and that they've also sought to become better able to deal with a larger type of war, a regional war, also conventionally, at least for some time, before Russia would rely or become dependent on resorting to nuclear weapons. So with regard to the conflict that we're currently seeing in Ukraine, essentially the implications of this argument is that this is the type of war that Russian planners and strategists have thought and sought to be able to deal with conventional forces only. And so not in this piece, but in other pieces that I've written since I published the article in the journal Strategic Studies, I make this argument that even if the conventional operation in Ukraine seems not to be going very well for the Russians, still, this looks like it remains what the Russians would call a local war, the type of war where they would not resort to nuclear weapons use, because Russia has been quite explicit in saying and declaring that for these types of wars, they would deal with them with conventional forces rather than with nuclear forces. That's not to say that there are not uncertainties with regard to the ongoing situation. Of course, we have seen, you know, an unprecedented level or reaction from Western countries, probably of a type that the Russian leadership and military planners, for that matter, were not able to anticipate. And so this type of war that Russia is dealing with at the moment, or the type of situation the Russians are dealing with, probably looks quite different and unprecedented in many ways from what Russian military planners are likely to have imagined. But nevertheless, it still continues to look like a kind of military confrontation where they do not need to resort to nuclear weapons.
Kristin, if I may, just a very quick clarifying question just for our listeners who are perhaps less familiar. You mentioned the modernization of Russia's conventional forces a lot. Can you just give a quick idea what we're talking about here?
So we are basically talking about a complete overhaul of the Russian conventional military capability that started from about the year 2008 and onwards. So after the war in Georgia that demonstrated significant shortcomings in the Russian conventional military capability, basically the entire Russian command structure was reorganized into joint forces commands with smaller units. So they shifted from a division-based structure into a brigade-based structure. There have been some changes to that structure again in the aftermath, but essentially the modernization was about making a smaller, leaner, more agile force with better equipment, basically across the range of the Russian Navy, the Russian Air Force, and the Russian Army, as well as a modernization of the Russian nuclear forces as well, in addition to this. So basically we are talking about a complete overhaul of the Russian the Russian armed forces, the military system that has produced at least a much more able and capable Russian military organization, even if it still seems to suffer some significant shortcomings if you compare it to Western militaries, for example. But we've seen, for example, the emergence of a number of relatively advanced Russian systems in the naval domain, in the air domain, et cetera, as a result of this modernization.
Kristin, let me pick up on some of the points you were making in your earlier response, where you're talking about the ways that Russia conceives of this relationship between conventional weapons and nuclear weapons, and in particular, non-strategic nuclear weapons. I'm wondering if you can help us understand, since this is such a topic of conversation right now, according to Russian strategy, doctrine, and force posture, at what point could a conventional war cross this nuclear threshold?
So Russian military deliberation and Russian exercises, Russian operations, and Russian doctrine as well, to some extent, demonstrate a much more direct link between conventional forces and nuclear forces, which of course is concerning to Western observers, because we are used to a much clearer delineation between conventional forces and nuclear forces. And also evidently it makes us concerned with regard to the current operation in Ukraine that we all hear about is not going very well for Russia, because we become concerned that this could mean that they are going to resort to nuclear weapons. And Russian doctrine and Russian planners have also theorized a lot in the past couple of decades about the link between nuclear and conventional forces, and about how both nuclear and conventional military capabilities can serve to influence a potential adversary also before actually being employed. So they have increasingly talked about the deterrent effect, not only of nuclear forces, but also of conventional forces. But that also entails, not necessarily seamless integration, but a much closer integration of nuclear and conventional forces. I would say, however, that there are some pretty clear indications, at least in Russian doctrine, that Russian strategists and Russian planners have still concluded that nuclear weapons are a different type of weapon, that they are special weapons that should be reserved only for the most severe warfighting situations that Russia could face. So they are very preoccupied with this deterrent effect of nuclear weapons. They're preoccupied with how the deterrent effect of nuclear weapons lend credibility to the deterrent effect of conventional weapons, but they're also concerned and remain concerned about the possibility of controlling escalation once nuclear weapons have or are in fact employed. So I would say that Russia's nuclear weapons in the current conflict in Ukraine certainly serve to influence the way that potential Russian adversaries such as the West perceive of this conflict and perceive of the potential consequences of becoming involved. I mean, I'm now depicting the Russian way of thinking about these issues, but also that the Russian signaling that we've seen so far pertains primarily to Russia's strategic nuclear weapons, and that also reinforces this point that this signaling is intended to convey to the West not to interfere, rather than a signal intended to convey to the West a Russian willingness to use non-strategic nuclear weapons, for example, on the battlefield in Ukraine. And I just saw today that the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, has reaffirmed that Russia will not use nuclear weapons on the battlefield in Ukraine, potentially or possibly, I would surmise, as a response to some of the statements that have been made in recent days by the CIA director Bill Burns, as well as by the Ukrainian Zelensky regarding potential nuclear use from the Russian side. So the case is this, that in Russian doctrine, in Russian planning, and in Russian exercising, it's possible to observe a much closer integration between conventional and nuclear forces, and that is in part a result of this Russian perception that they would not necessarily be able to deal with a large-scale conventional threat against the Russian homeland without resorting to the threat of nuclear use or actual nuclear use. But that's not to say that any military operation the Russians become involved with or in would include both conventional and nuclear weapons. They're just not necessarily dependent on nuclear weapons in all types of military conflict.
Kristin, this is super interesting. Just to come in on Russian perceptions, you put out a piece a few weeks ago, actually, in War on the Rocks, entitled Understanding Putin's Nuclear Decision-Making, in which you argue that, and you already said it, given what we know about Russian deterrence concepts, about Russian doctrine, the Russian military would be unlikely to advise President Putin to use nuclear weapons in Ukraine as long as the Russian reading of this war remains that of, as you called it, a localized conflict, a limited conflict, a non-regional conflict, and so one that does not pose an existential threat to the Russian Federation. What are the kinds of both nuclear and non-nuclear signals that analysts, but also the informed public, can be looking out for to understand as to whether that view in Moscow is changing?
So I mean, like everyone, we are struggling to gain insights into what precisely is going on in the Kremlin and how the decision-making process, well, in the mind of President Putin or in his closest circle actually takes place. So, of course, this question is riddled with much uncertainty. But there are some clues that we can look for, evidently, that can produce insight or some added concern, I would say. And one of the indicators or signs that we could look for when we are trying to decipher whether a decision to use nuclear weapons has been made or whether the Russian leadership is considering such nuclear weapons use is, for example, the type of rhetoric that is coming from the key Russian leadership. We've seen several statements from officials and spokespeople that at least I have deemed relatively, if not, I don't think calming is the right word, but at least reassuring in terms of actually reaffirming these doctrinal guidelines. So this is what we saw actually from Putin's press spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, when he was interviewed by Christiane Amanpour and was pressed on this issue with regard to nuclear weapons use. I mean, that produced headlines regarding how he would not deny that Russia would use nuclear weapons, whereas his statement was actually just confirming what has been longstanding Russian nuclear doctrine regarding nuclear weapons use. He was basically repeating these same issues regarding existential threats and that Russian nuclear weapons would only be used in such extreme circumstances. And now we've seen again a repetition of this stance from Prime Minister Lavrov. But evidently, you know, we have also seen numerous statements in the past as well as in relation to this current conflict that have later proved out to be false or to be untrue. We have seen much misinformation as well from the Russian leadership. So this indicator, of course, is a challenging one to say the least. But at least I would be very concerned if we started seeing the type of rhetoric that sort of aligns with Russian declaratory strategy regarding what types of actions could legitimize nuclear weapons use, then I would be very concerned. And that's one of the reasons I was, in fact, slightly concerned or alarmed by this Russian rhetoric regarding or accusations of Ukrainian WMD programs, because this is one of the legitimizing factors, if you will, that Russian nuclear doctrine actually stipulates as a potential reason for a Russian nuclear response. And then evidently, there are other sort of harder military indicators that it's not necessarily that easy to closely monitor using open source open sources, but that a number of institutions and organizations are paying close attention to with regard to, for example, the movement from these central storages of non-strategic nuclear weapons, and so far, at least from what we know from open sources, there have been no movements in such central storage locations of non-strategic nuclear weapons, and we've the activity that we have seen is related to the strategic nuclear weapons, and that activity, as far as I have seen or at least what I've been able to discern, seems to be of a relatively limited scale, even if we had this increased level of readiness at the onset of the crisis.
Thanks for that. That's really useful. And just to stay with your piece in War on the Rocks, you also argue that given all we know about Russian nuclear activity to date, it appears that President Putin is not the sole decision maker when it comes to nuclear movements. Can you explain to our listeners what we know about Russian nuclear consultation and decision making? And again, what the kind of cues are that we can look for in order to understand whether those patterns of consultation and decision making remain in place?
So the point I was trying to make in my piece is, well, first, that evidently, you know, in Russia, as in other nuclear weapon states, there is a large military bureaucracy, including one that is in charge of Russia's nuclear weapons complex, and that this bureaucracy is likely to have standard operating procedures, plans, and preferences for example, reinforcing their structures in a period of increased tension like we see today. So the point I was trying to convey was that there are bound to be a number of other actors in this domain who may make suggestions to President Putin and recommendations to President Putin regarding what types of actions are prudent to take in a situation like this. So I reference this statement that was made by the Norwegian defense minister that he had observed and that they had observed some changes or some reinforcement defensive measures surrounding the Russian Northern Fleet, and that this may be an example of how there may exist sort of prudent planning on part of the Russian strategic nuclear forces, where they take certain measures in order to make sure that they retain preparedness in a period of increased tension, and that those decisions may not necessarily, at least, originate with President Putin. It may well be that they are approved by President Putin, but that there is a whole system of plans and procedures that are in place and that may be put into play in a situation like this. And then the second point I wanted to make is that, again, this is an area that is riddled by uncertainty, and there are limits to what we can know, but the information that is available regarding the Russian command and control system is that there remain in Russia not only one, but three nuclear suitcases, and where one is with the Russian president, and we saw that depicted in some news reports a couple of weeks back, but that the two others are with the Russian general staff chief and with the Russian minister of defense. And the information that is available indicates that two out of these three suitcases need to be activated in order to issue a launch order for nuclear weapons. So this is a different system than the American system, for example, where the president alone actually has the authority to launch nuclear weapons with his nuclear football. As far as I can understand, the Russian system is slightly different in that there are instigated some checks and balances in that the supreme commander, that is the president, cannot alone issue the launch order. And as far as I understand, this was also the system during the Soviet period, and that it's the Soviet legacy that in part has ensured these checks and balances. But of course, there is some discussion regarding this, because we don't really know. We don't know if there have been made changes to the system in recent time, but at least as far as I've seen, there has been no information regarding such changes being made. And to the contrary, there are some reports that seem to reaffirm that this remains the system today. So again, that may be some point of consolation, if you will, that the Russian president may not be able to sit all alone and issue a nuclear launch order. But having said that, of course, you know, there have been uncertainties right now regarding the level of conflict within the Russian decision-making elite. There was uncertainty regarding the whereabouts of the defense minister, Shoigu, for some time. And these are all, you know, developments and issues that raise a lot of questions regarding these decision-making dynamics and that do not necessarily provide many answers.
Thanks for that, Kristen. You did mention Foreign Minister Lavrov's statement from earlier today, and also you acknowledged Dmitry Peskov's statement a few weeks ago in the CNN interview, as sort of reaffirming actually what we know about Russian nuclear doctrine. At the same time, it appears that we are entering a new phase of this war. The United States has shipped more and deadly weapons to Ukraine last week. As you know, there's a big push here in Europe for more weapons to go to Ukraine, especially in Berlin, where I'm sitting. That debate is now very much raging. And Russia has, in response, threatened to strike at command centers in Kyiv for what it says are alleged sort of cross-border incursions. The Russians have repeatedly warned NATO countries against delivering weapons to Ukraine. We had strikes against Lviv and in Western Ukraine yesterday. And then we have the start of a new offensive in the Donbas now, I think, as of the beginning of this week. Now, with all that taken together and with the continued quote unquote fog of war, are you more concerned now or increasingly concerned about potential miscalculations on both sides, really, regarding potential costs and consequences of action? More concerned than at the beginning of the war? Or how is your reading of the situation changing, specifically now when it comes to nuclear escalation ladders?
Yeah, so first of all, I would say that it remains pretty difficult, I think, to know precisely what the image of the conflict that the decision makers in Moscow currently have. I mean, we've also seen all these reports about what information Putin is provided with by his advisors, etc. So I think that's a pretty tough call to try and determine, you know, what precisely is the image or impression that they have of the situation on the ground in Ukraine, how well or how badly the operation is going from their perspective, and how far off they are from what something that could look like a victory, or something that they could declare as a victory and as achieving their political objectives that they have stated repeatedly that they will achieve in this conflict. And of course, I would also say that the longer this conflict drags on, the more concerned we could be or should be. Well, I mean, evidently, it's, you know, the longer this drags on, the more gruesome the results, it seems. I mean, we are on a weekly basis seeing absolutely horrifying reports of the results of this Russian operation. But having said that, I'm not entirely sure that the longer this conflict goes on in Ukraine, the larger the likelihood of nuclear escalation, as long as the Russian leadership deems that they have conventional forces that are available and that can be used for this type of conflict. And perhaps to repeat myself slightly, I'm not entirely sure that they would be convinced that resorting to nuclear weapons would produce the political outcomes that they seek to achieve in this conflict. I'm also not entirely sure about sort of the pathway to unintended nuclear escalation as a result of the fog of war, for example, in part because, as far as I understand, or as far as I know, there are nuclear weapons are not employed in the, or are not deployed to the theater of operations. Then I would posit that the likelihood of intentional escalation would be larger than the likelihood of unintentional escalation, at least in the context of the war between Ukraine and Russia. But having said that, if you start talking about or thinking about the potential for an escalation of this conflict, this conventional conflict, to involve also NATO, and you in this, and that could be an unintentional or inadvertent type of escalation that sort of pulled NATO forces into the conventional conflict, and that conflict started escalating to become basically direct shooting war between Russia and NATO, then I think the situation would be much different. Then I think the likelihood of escalation, of nuclear escalation, even as a result of the fog of war, would increase significantly. The moment you started having NATO strikes against Russian territory proper, for example, I think the Russians would become significantly concerned and would become concerned about the survival of their state, including if we take into account, you know, the depletion of Russia's conventional force availability as a result of the ongoing operation in Ukraine. That's not to say that the Russians wouldn't have any conventional force available, but it would certainly be very different, probably, from what Russian military planners have imagined when they have imagined a military confrontation with NATO, when they had probably imagined that they would start off with the full range of their conventional arsenal to run through first before they would need to start thinking about employing nuclear weapons. That situation would be quite different at this point in time.
As you know, the main objective of this videocast series is to really draw these connections between cutting-edge research, like what you do and what your colleagues do, and real-world challenges. And when it comes to the topics that we've been discussing, that's a very easy connection to make. But I want to drive it home in our last question here. So Russia's invasion of Ukraine has thrust nuclear weapons issues and considerations about how they might be used back into the public discourse. And for many people, including young people who may have come of age after the end of the Cold War, this may be the first time that they're really thinking in depth about questions like what we've been talking about here. You know, nuclear deterrence, nuclear escalation, the risk of nuclear use, things of that nature. So in closing, I'm wondering if you can offer us one insight from your research that you think would help people make sense of what they're hearing in the media and in the public discourse around these questions that are really difficult to understand and require a nuanced read of what is happening.
Yeah, so I guess one of my key takeaways or points is one that may not be sort of too popular, or perhaps it's slightly controversial these days when we are, you know, used to depictions of Russia as an aggressor and as a completely sort of unpredictable and irrational actor. But I still sort of come back to this notion that at least what I have found through my research is that even for Russia, nuclear weapons seem to be different, and that they seem to be special, and that they play a particular role in preserving Russian security, and that they are not a weapon that Russia would sort of resort to on any random day, precisely because they are so important to Russian security. And because the Russian leaders and military planners know that a nuclear war would also be the most dangerous situation that they would face. And I see, you know, in the commentary on the war in Ukraine, and in particular in recent days and weeks, there has been so much speculation about this issue of nuclear weapons use, where a lot of military analysts, with or without experience with observing Russia, claim that for Russia there is no difference between conventional and nuclear weapons. And I'm not sure this is right. At least my research has convinced me that that is not right. I think that Russian military leaders and also Russian political leaders, including President Putin, that's my personal observation, is aware of the nuclear taboo, and that breaking that taboo would come at a considerable cost for Russia. And, you know, I may be proved wrong in this, of course, in that Russian leaders may feel so cornered that this becomes a last desperate attempt or as a way out of this situation. But from my perspective, or at least my research has indicated to me, that I would posit that this is not a given. We should not sort of presume that, oh yeah, and at the end of the day, the Russians will resort to nuclear weapons. I don't think that's necessarily an inevitability. Of course, I do think that we and Western leaders should be prepared for that eventuality, because evidently there is a risk of that. But I also think that we should not treat it as a given, because I don't think it is.
I think, Kristin, this is a perfect way to end our conversation today. Thank you so much for joining us on Machiavelli in the Ivory Tower today and sharing the insights from years of scholarship on this incredibly important, but at the same time, at the moment, also very emotionally loaded and sensitive topic. So thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a great pleasure.